Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm pleased to have as my guest August Kleinzahler. He's the author, most recently, of Cuddy One Rock, Low Characters and Strange Places Gently Explained, is its subtitle. It's published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. It's a book of mostly autobiographical essays. There's a selected poems of sorts, live from the Hong Kong Nile Club, which I remember reading was a misseen neon sign live from the Hong Kong nightclub, right, which he said would be of no interest whatsoever. The previous book of poems, The Strange Hours Travelers Keep, as well as Red Sauce, Whiskey and Snow, Green Sees Things in Waves. These are the books that are published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. Now tell me, how did the essay writing begin?
Well, in stages. The I think the earliest one in that book was the movie review of Leaving Las Vegas. And that's actually how the book began, because Jonathan Galassi, the editor-in-chief there, his assistant at the time, had read the review in the Three Penny Review and gotten a kick out of it, and had become a fan of what he thought was a body of work that really didn't exist. And he subsequently became an editor there and pushed for a collection. And during that time, I had begun writing more extended essays for the London Review of Books, where and pretty much publishing both poetry and prose for the last, 7 or 8 years. And so it was a rather late development in my life, in my late 40s, really.
And the subject matter, which is familial for the most part, takes a lot of risks with the feelings of the people being written about. I wondered if you could describe your position as narrator of these essays, because it seems similar to that in the poems. Someone is being simultaneously intimate and distanced through device, it seems to me. Mm. And often humor is, in fact, the device that makes distance possible. Would you agree?
Humor, in part, and I would say voice, and shifting, changing registers of voice. One of the registers is humor, and different kinds of humor. But I don't consider myself a humorist, but I have that arrow in my quiver, and it's useful to me. The first family piece I wrote was the one about my brother, and I had intended to write that at some point in my life. I imagined some point where I'd be in New York teaching or subletting an apartment or something, and being in that atmosphere, I could step into it and recreate that. Very interesting and very difficult window of time. But it didn't work out that way. I did it in San Francisco. I think it was, when I think back about it, I think it was precipitated by seeing someone I hadn't seen in a long time, and which was very emotional. And it seemed to loosen something in me. And I wrote that and a number of other things. And then after that, when we were talking about putting a book together, Glassy and the young editor, Lauren Stein, both of whom I'm very grateful to, and You know, they're old-fashioned kinds of editors. They're hands-on, and you know, they take chances, and they don't mind getting their hands dirty or worrying about my feelings or you know, I can interact with them. They said the book needed another hump, another long piece, like the Cuddy piece. And conveniently, my parents both seemed to be dying. As it turned out, my mother didn't die, but it seemed evident at the time. And we had a difficult relationship, and so that was very emotional, and it was there. And I went back to San Francisco after being in New York, and I promised to deliver the hump by Labor Day when Jonathan was going to get back. And I delivered the hump, and somewhere in there I wrote the household tale, because now that I was walking into that area, which was a very a bit of an emotional minefield, I found that I was able to talk about things, explain things. I'd found a way in that I'd never really had. I discovered a way in, yeah. And so that's the genesis of the family bits.
You have a fondness, it seems, similar to that of Dennis Johnson in the Hotel Incognito Lounge, to find a place, a dive, or a watering ground, and give it its character in prose. There's a fabulous piece in this collection of essays, Cuddy One Rock, about the Zamzam Room, or you can give the whole title of the room.
Well, it was the Persian Aub Zamzam Room, and it was a neighborhood bar in the Haight in San Francisco. Despite all its sort of esoteric veneer, it was a working man's bar. And it had a rather odd, rather fascinating, extremely grumpy and opinionated proprietor. And once you met with his approval, which was like studying with a Zen master. It could go on for years, and you know, and you were, if not hit with the paddle, you were verbally abused. It was like a club. It was like being in his living room, and it was great fun. And I'm sure my liver is larger and harder on account of it, and my bank account more slender than it might otherwise have been. But for 20 years, it was a great place for me to sit between the hours of 4:45, and if I was smart, I'd get out of there before 6, because if I stayed till 6:30, I'd have a headache the next day at work.
Finding the real thing seems to be the subject of a lot of your work, as in knowing the difference between those who are writing yet another soggy meditation in the name of poetry, or in recognizing, I would think, the actual qualities of your teacher, Basil Bunting, who, while not a very well-known poet, was perhaps for his lifetime the finest writer of poetry in English. That was Hugh Kenner's opinion, and I'll stand by it.
Oh, I'll stand by that as well.
Yeah. That quest for the real is not dissimilar to what Ezra Pound was doing in his different way, to find the thing that represented the true art, the thing that should last, what you love will stay. And it seems as if these books are in certain ways about looking for the genuine thug, the real bar, the true adventurer, the gambler who has no hope of cure.
Right.
Tell me about that quest for the real.
Well, I'm more drawn to the real. I'm not a fabulist. I write about what most vividly claims my attention, and I saw a silly movie with my recently deceased friend Tom Gunn. We used to go to the movies all the time. A Johnny Depp movie where he's a pirate, and I forget what it's called. It was out last year, and every once in a while, the Johnny Depp pirate character would go off register and see something very strange, and say, "That's interesting." And it was though, I forget what you'd call that in theater, where the actor goes out of the play and addresses the audience.
And a sotto voce thing.
Yeah, an aside. And, you know, sometimes months will go by, sometimes years, and I'll run into a situation or a landscape or a person. And something inside me will go, "That's interesting." And
Now, there was a time when you were not the American you are now. There's a wonderful series of lightning-fast portraits of your mother who takes you to her instruction one day and says, "It's back to the good old USA for you, babykins. Let's lose the Kafka accent. It's giving your father and me the creeps, and your brother and sister are too embarrassed to bring home any of their friends. You're going to speak like an American child and act like an American child, and while you're at it, wipe the schmutz off your chin."
I'm glad you got that one. I like that one. My mother loves that, by the way. Even though there's some rough things said about her in there, she thinks that's the funniest thing she ever read. You know, it's the whole thing is done in a surreal or magic realism sort of way, in a household tale, as in a Grimm's fairy tale. But everything is more or less true. We had a Czech housekeeper who was wonderfully kind to me. And my mother, who is in many ways wonderful, wasn't very interested in mothering. And I spent all my time with this lovely, kind, older woman. And so as little of my mother as possible. I think the feeling was mutual. And I didn't realize until I think my sister told me, or my sister and my when I was grown, or at least a teenager, that she and my brother were embarrassed to bring friends home because of my accent. And then I asked about it, and apparently I did have a thick Czech accent, which is, it was sort of a amusing to my folks to a point. But I think as I get to be five or six, they could, and you know, making ready to go into the public school system, that this was something that had to be taken care of. And also that generation, my parents are first generation Americans. Their parents had accents, and they were very, very careful about their elocution. Much more, I have a much thicker accent, and use far more vulgarities than either of them. They were very proud of speaking English correctly and very embarrassed by their parents. So to have a child who sounded like he was from the old country would have been a cross for them to bear.
I'm speaking to August Kleinsauer, the author most recently of a book of essays called Cuddy One Rock. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and you're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. But that project of being an American poet, what does that mean to you?
You know, I'm very much out of the Pound and William Carlos Williams tradition. There are inflections from New York writers like O'Hara and Schuyler and foreigners and this one and that one. But I'm American as apple pie or borscht or piggies in the blanket. I think part of my appeal to the Brits in particular is that I sound so American, and part of what I'm interested in doing with language involves spoken language instead of elevated language.
Or swoops between them.
Yes. I'm an inveterate swooper.
When you talk about the American voice, what is it you're talking about in poetry?
In my experience, it's a matter, and I'm speaking personally, it's a matter of creating the illusion that you're using spoken language through rather sophisticated rhythmic devices and syntactical devices like you know suspension and periodicity or whatever it's called. It's hard to do. It's a technical activity.
Well, I found a poem in your most recent book, The Strange Hours Travelers Keep, that I was crazy about. I wouldn't be able to answer what precisely it's doing, but it seems to me to be exactly what you're talking about, creating the illusion of the immediacy of a particular sensibility. I wondered if you would read it.
Sure. Hyperbersus, 3 a.m. Imagine, in all the debris of space, the countless trade names. Jugurtha, Tuolumne, Chert Farms. Some of these belong to you. Can you tell me which ones? Each has its own sequence of microtones. Together, they make up a kind of tune, your tune. The ceiling and walls are star maps. Breathing, alive. Those aren't stars, darling. That's your nervous system. Nana didn't take you to planetariums like this. Go on, touch. Lovely, isn't it? Like phosphorus on Fool Lake. Sweet summer midnights. Shimmery, like applause under the skin. Can you make it out? Almost a hiss, an old shellac LP of white noise playing in the distance. Foolish, troublesome boy, that hapless adventuring of yours. Be very still. Now can you hear it?
August Kleinsanger. Now, that, when I hit like applause under the skin, I kind of fell apart, you know, because it... I mean, it's that radical state of being so extremely fried. And to have what seems sometimes to be the grandma's voice doing a guided tour of the soul in extremis seems really amazing to me.
Oh, I'm glad you liked it.
Where does that poem come from? Tell me.
Lying in bed at 3 a.m. In extremis, as opposed to in delecto. Like that, being so psychologically stretched and in the quiet.
The centerpiece essay, Cuddy One Rock, in the book Cuddy One Rock, is a piece that strikes me that poetry schools, teachers, and time made it nearly impossible to write. That is to say, most of us grow up going to schools where we're asked to write a composition of the most unforgettable character I ever knew.
Right.
Although how, if you didn't know him, he would be unforgettable. You know, the redundancy factor is part of the nature of the sickness of the assignment. And we grow up saying, oh, no, I have to write an essay about my dad. You know, and you can't imagine who to write it to or who to write it for. Who would care about it if it were to be written? And yet you manage here to write a piece about your brother who died. And you don't do it by ripping it up into pieces and making it avant-garde. You don't do it by over-emotionalizing. There's something that happens here. It's one of the very few essays of this kind that I am able to read, and to read with a kind of odd fascination. He really isn't going to do any trickery to bring the subject home. This really is going to be a memory piece. It's not going to have punchlines, and it's going to say what it was like to have a brother who was all kinds of things but didn't know what he was. And I wondered how you did it.
I don't know. You know, I'd never done anything like that before. I think that's the way I did it. It was the first time through. I'm a sprinter. I'm a lyric poet, and I sat down and the first draft is pretty much what you see there. So the organization of it, I think, because I was doing it. Just roaring through it, it's probably organized like a poem, and you know, my instinctive organizational routine found its way into prose. Simply because I had never done it before, and. And I found a voice, and I'm accustomed to using voice, but I found a voice that could was flexible enough to cover the various registers: the tragic, the comic, the bitter, the what have you, nostalgic. And once I had the voice and got that going, I instinctively know how to do transitions, and it was done. And I didn't know what I had. It was very emotional. I'd never had this experience at a typewriter. I mean, I'm not saying this for effect. You know, I don't do this. I'm not ashamed of doing it, but I was weeping copiously, and I mean, I really was aware that something cathartic was going on. But on the other end, you know, I was disciplined enough as a writer to be fascinated by what was coming out of the typewriter. So it was an adventure.
I'm going to ask you to read the final paragraph of that essay, Cuddy One Rock, because I want in particular to ask you about the strategy of the final sentence. This is August Kainzahler reading the conclusion of an essay about his older brother who died young. The final paragraph elevates in tone in order to do something else, and it really stunned me.
I used to go visit him in the city when he still lived in Chelsea, not long after he'd moved to town. I was finishing high school. Maybe a couple of times a year, no more, I'd take the train downtown from the Bronx instead of going back to Jersey. I was wretchedly unhappy at school and at being 16, and I would confess to him all my anxieties, all my perceived failings and inadequacies. I couldn't have made for a very thrilling company, but he always acted glad to see me. He never put me down or pulled a disapproving face. "You'll be all right, lover boy," he'd say, smiling. "Let's go out and see if we can't find ourselves a drink." I miss having someone like that in my life. I miss it like a limb.
August Kleinsaller reading the last paragraph of his essay. It's a risk, because suddenly something that's been factual and tending toward the rhythms of nostalgia becomes metaphoric. And the phantom limb, the leap into metaphoric language is sudden, and then I couldn't read that without holding the book for like 10, 15 seconds because it drew me up short. I think back when I was growing up and hearing people talking about poetry in ways I didn't understand, Robert Bly used to call something like that leaping poetry, the sudden leap into a different mode of discourse altogether. But it's a characteristic effect for you in a way.
One of the first people who read it told me to leave the last thing out because he said it was too much. And I could see where he's coming from. It's a risk. That's what's interesting or not interesting about it. As with the whole piece, I wasn't doing it for a literary effect. I was trying to say something plainly. I couldn't think of anything else that painful. It just came. I've listened to people talk, people who've had limbs amputated, and talk about the phantom pain, which is an intriguing notion, and it is. He was the person dearest in the world to me, and it was a terrible loss.
I've been speaking to August Kleinsaller on the occasion of the publication of his book of essays, or autobiographical essays, Cuddy One Rock, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
You can read an excerpt from Cuddy One Rock on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.